Hey, welcome to J11 Fitrospective Bodybuilding Sports and Wellness. Speed, but not just any speed. We are talking about the speed that only the very few are endowed with. We're talking about speed that is actually considered a genetic lottery. The speed that defies the stopwatch, that makes coaches, fans, track and field enthusiasts flock from all over the world to see those that are considered unworldly run. But yet still, this must be cultivated. Still, this must be trained. But we must consider this. This is only given to very few. This is actually generational talent. Consider the ACTN3 gene that actually fires quick twitch fiber that makes these individuals run just that much faster than any other human beings on, I will say this, the planet. And today with me is one of these individuals that ran with Canada's super team. We were blessed with an embarrassment of riches in Canada. We have and had undoubtedly a crop of talented sprinters that Canada may never, ever have again. This sprinter pushed through adversity, pushed through things that would make most men fold. I'm proud of this man. I am proud of this man. And I'm proud to have him here as a guest. My man, Anthony, the Jet. I said the Jet. I mean the Jet. Well said. How are you doing, buddy?
Well, thank you. And thank you for that introduction. I'm very honored and humbled to be a part of your show and to be invited to your show. So thank you.
Okay. So let's move these pieces. Anthony Wilson, Quebec champion in the 100, 200, and 400, youth national champion, 200 meter champion, number one rated in Canada. Went on to the U, Northern Arizona, Big Sky Conference champion, 400 meter champion, and the record still stands today. Four-time 200 meter champion record still stands today. Four-time 200, 400 meter champion, relay conference champions, three-time All-Americans. Ran in the Pan Am American Games, World Championships, Olympics in Barcelona, and the Francophone Games. Now, that is a resume. I said, that is a resume. Okay, let's move these pieces. Anthony, can you please speak about your beginnings? What do you believe was your desire and passions? When do you believe your earliest memory was when you first felt the quickening in your spirit that you wanted to run, you wanted to sprint? Or basically, did you come out of your womb and say, okay, I'm a sprinter?
Well, you know, that's a good question. And thanks for asking that question. I knew I wanted to run very earlier on. I used to race in the streets. I was born in Jamaica. So, you know, we always used to race. I used to race my cousins in the street. And these are battles that started from, you know, probably when I was 8 years old, 9 years old. And, you know, I was inspired by my cousin and my best friend, who was 2 years older than me, around that time when he went on to win the middle school championship. And then when I came to Canada, you know, I made a promise back then that, you know, I wanted a medal, because he had won a medal and I wanted to have a medal like him. So, you know, when I came to Canada, I kind of sought out where I could, you know, compete in track and field and get a medal like him. And and it kind of started from there. And I registered myself. No one registered me. I was in Montreal, and one day one of the students came back with some medals, and I was like, "Hey, where did you get those medals?" It was like, I ran, you know, in a track meet, and I was like, "Well, how can I, you know, register?" And I saw that the coach, and registered myself, and the journey began from there.
Okay. So now, when did you actually realize your potential? Because, I mean, there's one thing about registering yourself and one thing about having the desire, but at what point do you say, wait a second, I think I may have something here?
You know, I always knew I was fast. You know, and everybody in the neighborhood knew I was fast. They nicknamed me Quarry, which is one of her, one of Jamaica's national sprinter at the time, and won the Olympics in the 200 meters, I believe, in the 76 Olympics. So they nicknamed me Quarry from, you know, since I was like 9 years old. So everyone knew I was fast. I was racing the older kids and beating them and, you know, keeping up with them. But when I really, truly, so that desire was already there. And by the time I got to maybe around 14, I realized that I wanted to go to the Olympics, and that was always a goal. So I knew very earlier on that I wanted to compete in the Olympics, and that was a long-term goal for me, even at 14.
Okay, so that's very interesting. So knowing this, we don't necessarily have, like going back then, the facilities are not the same. So what were you maybe doing to train yourself to try and prepare for, you know, track and field or for the events? You know, I mean, you know, basically, you know, just dirt tracks, you know, you know, that's all we really had. What were you doing?
Well, you know, there were many challenges, because, again, I'm the one that took the initiative to register myself. I didn't have my mom, you know, or my dad was driving me to the track. I had to come up with, you know, registration money if that was the case. Fortunately, I was part of the Athletics West Track Club in Côte d'Ivoire, and that was a community-run organization. So it was funded by the government, and I had a very supportive coach in the sense that he gave me spikes to run. They were used, but gave me spikes to start. And, you know, we kind of started from there. But, you know, the facilities were lacking. There weren't any indoor facilities. So, you know, to train, I was running on, you know, concrete at Lindsay Place High School at the time. And and you witnessed to that.
Yes. hold on. Wait. Here's the story. Here's the story. I gotta tell you something. So that was the first time I would actually say that I saw some pure discipline. I'm going back up to my locker, and this is after school. And I saw something flash by me. And it was Anthony running the quarters over. I said, okay, wait, I'm going to watch this for a second. Over and over and over. And what seemed, and think about it, it wasn't like at half speed. What seemed to be, I don't know, 45 minutes over and over and over and over again. So, yes, this is true. Everybody else hanging out and doing, I don't know, whatever. And this guy would not stop. So that's exactly what happened. Yes, continue. This happened.
Yeah, and that's not even an exaggeration. That is true.
No, it's not an exaggeration. Yes, this happened.
Yeah, so, you know, as an athlete, you never really want to compete or train on hard surfaces because it causes shin splint and it can cause a lot of injuries. So it wasn't the ideal situation, but that's the best I had to work with, you know, and within that context, you know, I made sure that I put in the work because I wanted to be the best. I was already the best, you know, even with no training. I mean, I really, really started training. Like I would race, but I don't consider that really competing until you actually start training. So I really started training when I was about 15 for track. You know, I was already, you know, top two, you know, top two are the best in the province, but I wanted to be even better. So, you know, I was making sure that I put in the work. And since I had long-term goals of competing in the Olympics, you know, even then, you know, I think I was even thinking about possibly, you know, scholarship offers at that time, even though I had limited knowledge. So yeah, I wanted to make sure that I put in the work, and it kept me, you know, disciplined. It kept me away from, you know, trouble and getting involved in things that I, you know, I would get into if I was, you know, had all that time to just idle, you know?
Okay. So, yeah. Okay. So using that as a segue, would you say that even at that age, would you say that training in Canada may have been a detriment, I mean, as far as your move forward aspirations?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you know, now that I'm older and I've been, you know, through that journey and looking back, you know, I can see how much my development was impeded, not only from a facility standpoint, but also from, you know, a coaching expertise standpoint. We had coaches who were just, they weren't really coaches. They were just teachers who were just helping out and volunteering. And, you know, I'm very fortunate, you know, and happy that they volunteered their time. You know, you have to respect that. But at the same time, from a developmental standpoint, they, you know, impede the progress as opposed to enhance it. Because, you know, if, like, for example, someone who's doing improper training or doing too much volume, you know, that can stall your career and impede your development. So, you know, sometimes, you know, if you're doing things the wrong way, it can have a very long lasting effect. And, you know, with track and field, it's such an efficient sport that, you know, if you get an injury, it can just lag and lag and lag. And then now you have to get physio and all sorts of treatment that you may not have the resources to take care of, but it can last for years, you know, and that can definitely be detrimental to your long-term career.
Exactly. Like form is so important and mechanics are so important.
Yes.
And to run relaxed is so important. So basically if you have now, okay, program the body to run the wrong way, trying to bring that back can be extremely difficult.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And that's what happened with me. You know, I was a sprinter. I was the fastest 50 meter to 400 meter runner, but yet I was training as a distance runner. I was training, you know, the kind of volume that I was doing was not conducive to sprinting at all. And that was in a critical point in my development. So, you know, you know, although I was breaking every single record there was in Quebec at that time, you know, I still, you know, could have been further ahead. And then, you know, by the time I came to Toronto or Ontario, you know, then we started sprinting. So, you know, the base that I had didn't really prepare me for that transition from distance to sprinting. So I got hurt. And that lasted for 2 years. And it was just a battle of trying to recover and trying to get back to health, you know. But I battled through, you know, did what I had to do in terms of, you know, maintaining my body and trying to, you know, get as much physio that I can. And, you know, just did enough.
Okay. Actually, this is a very, very important phase. And I am hoping that the viewers heed this. Can you please speak to that period of time when you were at Central Tech and then from Central Tech on to Northern Arizona? The period of time that, okay, first of all, you're going on to the powerhouse Central Tech track and field team that was notorious for shattering records and basically annihilating everybody in Ontario, and from what I understand, actually even the United States through a various track and field events. But it is through this period that you persevered and launched you actually to cultivate the tenacity that made you a champion. Can you please speak to this?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, when I left Montreal and left Lindsay Place and came to Toronto and you know, joined up with, you know, the powerhouse Central Tech in track and field and just sports in general, you know, we had a history of Olympians and Canadian representative already prior to me getting there. So I just added to what was already there. And, you know, it was a different culture because, you know, we had, everybody was very passionate about track and field. And, obviously the demographics was very different, in the sense that there's a strong history in the Jamaican culture when it comes to track and field. And there were a lot of Jamaicans at the school as well, and they ran track. So, you know, it was a fantastic time in track and field in general. You know, there were capacity crowds at, you know, the Garden, Maple Leaf Garden, and there was a capacity crowd at like Hamilton Spectator Game, and you know, we were always in the paper. So, you know, culturally, it was just a movement, you know, and we broke the Interscholastic 4x4 record, which is the Canadian record. And we also broke the Canadian 4x1 record that year. And we also put three guys on the Canadian national team from one high school, which is like unprecedented. So, you know, we were a dominant force. We went to the United States in Ohio, and, you know, we dominated there as well at the Mihawk Relays. Unfortunately, we never got a chance to go to Penn Relays, which at that time we didn't even know what Penn Relays was, but that would have been ideal because we'd have been able to clash against some of the big schools from Jamaica and big school from the US. But yeah, you know, that was a tremendous experience. I was very happy to be part of that. I was, you know, probably the happiest time in my track career because everybody was so involved and everybody was so passionate, as passionate about the sport as I was. So I really liked that.
The injury that at times things happen that seem to be detrimental, which you turned to be the best thing that ever happened to you. Speak to that.
Well, you know, obviously having to come over that, get over that injury when I first got to Tech, you know, was, it was extremely difficult. You know, it was many, many days and hours at the physio, getting muscle stem, ice in, stretching, trying to recover from that. And unfortunately, you know, I never recovered, you know, even though I did all that, because what ended up happening was the injury became a chronic injury, you know, and, you know, I just had inflammation in the joints or ligaments. And, you know, I think the therapy that I was doing at the time was just not the right therapy for it. So, you know, but it takes a lot of mental toughness, a lot of determination to continue to fight through all that, because I could have easily have just said, you know what, this is too much. It wasn't like I had, you know, a huge supporting cast. It was just me and me alone that was pushing through. So, you know, that was it. But I think that the biggest motivator for me was when the year before coming to Tech, I didn't make the junior national team, and that was the first time that anybody in my age group had ever beaten me. But I wasn't preparing for the junior national because I didn't know what the junior national was, and I started training in May when normally I would start training in September. So I had missed a lot of training because I was playing football during the fall, and then, you know, got a slight injury in January. So I'd missed a lot of time, and, you know, but not making that junior team, even though I went on to being, you know, the second fastest junior in Canada just a month later, really lit a fire, you know, and fuel my drive even more, because, you know, I wanted to make the junior team. And the fact that, you know, I did make that junior team that year, and that was the first time that racing anybody my age that was even able to compete with me on that level, you know, really kind of sent a very strong message. But that was the first time the second time I was facing like a national competing body, so to speak, where I'm facing all the Canada's best. So yeah, so that was a huge driving force, and I said that, listen, there's no way the next year I'm not making that team. And I made that team. You know, I became the Canadian number one 200 meter sprinter the next year. And, you know, when I was a juvenile, I was the youth champion in Canada, and then as a junior, the best junior for that year. And then after that, yeah, you know, I had Northern Arizona and Ohio State, you know, calling me and asking me if I want to come down for a scholarship. And, you know, that's when the journey really started.
Okay. So I'm going to roll back a little bit. So essentially what you're saying is that during that period where it was a little dark, you ended up being the kid that was running tenaciously around the quarters over and over and over and over again. And you had that fire in your belly, which led to that coach from Northern Arizona to pursue you over and over and over, over and over again. And then you went on to Northern Arizona. And then when you got there, what happened? You immediately, not through a series of progressions, you immediately broke every single record over and over again, which still stand today. Am I correct?
That is correct. You know, the fact that I wasn't getting proper training in Canada, whether it was in Montreal or in Toronto, you know, and, you know, once I did get a coach that knew, you know, half of what, you know, knew what he was doing, a competent coach, you know, the first time I step on the track, I improve immediately. You know, I improve by 2 seconds in the 200 meters, I mean, in the 400 meters. And I broke the NAU or the Northern Arizona University record in the 400 meter. I made to the NCAAs. And then the next year I broke my record again and broke the conference record. And then I also broke the 200 meter record. And then the next year I broke the 400 meter record and the 200 meter record again. So every year that I was there, I was breaking my own records, and not only the university record, but I was breaking the conference record as well. And those records are still there today. If you Google my name at Big Sky Conference, you'll see I'm on the all-time list. And you'll see that I'm holding my university record even after those many years. So, you know, that was the journey. And from Northern Arizona, a great school, really built me as a person in terms of, you know, my academic achievements there, and also allowed me to develop and nurture my talent. And I was able to go from there onto the Pan American game, the World Championship, and the Olympics. And those were, you know, obviously memorable moments.
Fantastic. Absolutely fabulous. Fabulous. So how would you rate, besides track and field, I'm saying overall, how would you rate your overall experience in the U.S.? Like going to school, leaving Canada and going to the U.S. I know that we touched on that and I found it very interesting.
Well, you know, considering I had a lot of naysayers, I had a lot of people saying, you know, why are you going to the U.S.? When I was going down, you should stay in Canada. There were a lot of stereotypes about, the racist tension at that time, to you know, the institution, the academic institutions down there. So there are a lot of misconceptions, you know, and there are a lot of ignorance, you know. And I even remember one coach saying, well, why don't you just go to U of T, or why don't you just go to Western? They have a great you know, business program. And you know, but once I got there, I realized that those were all myths. And you know, it was a tremendous experience. They really truly put you in a situation where you can excel, and they really truly put you in a situation where you will develop, you know, based on where you are. And I really like that, you know, from an academic standpoint, they will, you know, they'll test your English to see where your English is at, and then they'll place you accordingly. They'll test your math to see where your math is at, and they'll, you know, they'll place you accordingly. So if you're doing, you know, calculus, or, you know, if you're below that, then you'll be in calculus. And so, you know, and if you ever if you weren't performing, you know, up to standard academically, then they'll put you on probation so that you can get some extra tutoring and get your grade up to where you need to be in order to compete. So if your grade wasn't, let's say, you know, above 75%, then, you know, you can't compete, you know, then you're just, they put you on probation. Fortunately, I never had those issues, you know, because I took my education very seriously. And, you know, but they were, you know, along the way, they were always there supporting you. Your professors made themselves available. You weren't in a class where there's like, you know, 100 or 200 or 300 students. You know, oftentimes you were in a classroom where there was like 30 students. So you get to know your professors, fairly well. And, you know, if you ever need to speak to them, you could always go to their office after class and discuss certain things. So I really like that. And just generally from a cultural standpoint, yeah, it was great. You know, campus life was great. It was just so different from everything that I had experienced up until that point. You know, everything revolves around university life, from all the football team, basketball team, everybody comes out to support as a community. And you have all the fraternities, you know, which has long rooted traditions, and they take that very seriously. They have all their chapters across the many universities throughout, and they do a lot of events and have a lot of connection in terms of jobs, opportunities, and so forth, you know, afterwards. So, you know, that was all new, and, you know, and just being able to travel across the United States every weekend and see all the different cities and see the infrastructure and the kindness of the people that I met, you know, in the Southwest.
Okay. So, given the information you just provided and a little off topic, by the way, viewers, this man here could have easily played professional football. I saw him play. Yeah, you're laughing, but he was that good. Gifted with tremendous speed, vision. He could block, he could catch, and just about every single time he touched on football, six. So, taking that into account, I'm just curious. Would you rather have went to school and trained in Canada if the facilities were somewhat similar? That's a question that I'm quite curious about.
Well, honestly,
I kind of loaded. It's a loaded question.
Honestly, I think, you know, I think at the time when, at that time in, you know, when I was making my decision, I think if the situation was right, I would have stayed in Canada because I didn't really know what I was missing in the United States. You know, I think if the facilities was there, if the funding was there in terms of scholarship in Canada, which was non-existent at that time. So, you know, if they were offering scholarship in Canada, I would have definitely stayed in Canada because, you know, I was in a relationship. I was in love. I was having so much fun. I was loving Toronto, you know, and literally I was like loving the city, and maybe too much so, because when I went away, I was still missing the city and couldn't detach myself from the city. And so I would have definitely stayed, but, you know, again, the opportunity never presented itself. I couldn't get a scholarship. I couldn't go on to university unless I was going to fund it myself. And again, the coaching wasn't here. The facility wasn't here. And I didn't realize how bad it was until I left and came back and then try to train. And then I realized, whoa, you know, the transportation is difficult to get from point A to point B in the city. You know, the track, it's short and it's hard. The surface is hard. So, again, we spoke earlier about running on concrete and, you know, and the kind of damage that it can do to your shin splint and the tightness on your muscles. Yeah, again, the tracks were very hard, very tight. So you're constantly, to perform at a high level, you constantly need massages. You constantly need to maintain your body. You could do one training, but you couldn't come back and do another hard training the next day. Sometimes you have to take 2-3 days off. Those are things that you don't have when the climate is hot and you have good facility that is, you know, soft and those sort of things. You can go on the grass and so forth. So, yeah, it was really, really tough, you know. It was really, really tough, you know. And I can say that after I graduated and came back to Canada, it was a daunting task, you know, and then funding on top of that, you know, you still have to pay for coaches, you still have to pay for physio. You know, I would work at TD and then I would have to travel an hour up to York, an hour back. I wouldn't get back until like 10 o'clock at night. Then I'd have to ice. So by the time I get to bed, it was probably 11 or 12. And then I have to get up in the morning at like 7. So it was really a challenge, you know.
So sleep, and then on top of that, nutrition.
Nutrition, yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
And unfortunately, it's still problematic in many sports. And I think Canada still, I mean, it's getting much better, but they still need to catch up. I'm sorry if I'm rubbing somebody the wrong way, but you need to catch up. Sorry. Anyways, moving on. So how did you end up being invited to Canada's national team? I think a lot of people would be very interested to finding out how this transpired.
So again, to get on the national team, it's a long process. First, you have to meet the national championship standard just to compete in the national championship or the Olympic trials. Not everybody can come. And then after that, you still have to meet the Olympic standard or the world championship standard, which is measured globally, not just within the country. It's an international standard. And then once you meet that standard, then you have to win the trial or place within the top three to make the team. And sometimes it can be really tough because you have to meet the standard within a certain time frame. And as you know, we're a winter country, so you may not get that many opportunities to meet the Olympic standard or the world championship standard because you're just not competing. And even if you're competing, you're not competing against high standards. So unless you're in the U.S. competing within the NCAA system, or you're in the U.S. and you're getting meets in warm climate that is conducive to running fast. But the truth of the matter is that the only time you will get an opportunity to compete is in May here. And the weather is very unpredictable. Sometimes it's beautiful. Other times it may be snowing. So, and sometimes the trial is in June. So by the time you may get one or two meets in, it's already the Olympic trials, and you may have already missed the time, the cutoff to meet the Olympic standard. So there are a lot of things that are going against you, you know, if you decide to stay here. And, you know, you really need a coach who understands how to train in cold weather, how to train on hard surfaces, how to train on tight tracks, and how to get away for training camps during the cold months. So you're, you know, in January and February and those sort of things. So you can train during those months and then you come back and then you go away. That's the only way you can do it, but that costs money, you know, so you need funding, you need sponsors, those sort of things to train like that. The vast majority of Canadian sprinters today do not reside in Canada, do not train in Canada. They all have either gone to the United States, trained, come through the NCAA system, and are currently in camps or living in the United States outside of Canada. There may be one or two, but they're very, very few. Now, that being said, that was not always the case. When I was, you know, in university, the vast majority of Canadians were either, you know, were staying in Canada, you know, or didn't go away. So I was kind of, my going away was part of that genesis, so to speak, to push everybody. Because when I came back, especially at my university, you know, a lot of guys didn't even think they were going to go away, but I educate them in terms of what to expect, how to go about it. And a lot of people took that, you know, advice and end up leaving. And then it just started spreading from there, from the coaches that I was associated with in high school. And it just kind of mushroomed. And now everybody goes away. If you're not going away, it's like, what's wrong with you? You know? So everybody goes down. That includes basketball players are going to prep school as well. So they're out, and football players as well. So nobody really stays in Canada.
Well, as far as logistics, you almost have to. Okay, because you spoke about funding, and it goes on and on. And then on top of that, I imagine, like as you have elegantly spoken of the logistics. I mean, how do you simulate running indoors with running outdoors? It's very difficult. okay, even just as far as even breathing, okay, oxygen coming in, oxygen coming out. As then suddenly you're going, sometimes you're gonna have to run at altitudes, okay. Now what I'm very interested in knowing is that when you're going to run internationally, then now there's another for lack of a better word, duress on funding. So like, because you've got to be at, again, if you're going to compete in Europe, you need funding because you've got to be wherever you're going to be competing, probably weeks ahead. Am I correct?
Yeah, so that works a little bit different, but you do need funding. Now, they do have a program called Cardin. That's the program that they have, and I think they still have that program today. Yes. But you have to, so you have a hopeful card, and then you have like an elite card. But you have to get to a certain level before that fund is even available to you. And again, we're talking about like maybe, you know, $400 a month back then, you know. So, I mean, that can't pay for much, right? You know, $400 a month. And oftentimes that funds were given to guys who don't need that money, guys who had sponsors already and was doing well in the sport. So it's not really those guys that really need it. The guys who need it are the guys who have shown potential and is on the cuff to get to the next level. The guys who are, you know, already doing quite well don't need that kind of money. Now, to get to Europe, if you get to that level where you can go on the circuit and you're, you know, you're high, and I competed on the circuit as well, then that's a different level. Then the meat promoters in Europe will pay your way over. Your agent will pay your way over, and then they'll give you an opportunity to make some money on the circuit.
Okay. All right. So how did it feel when you finally got to that level, Anthony?
Well, you know, that's a good question. You know, I felt like I remember being in Barcelona, Spain, and you know, I realized that I'd realized my dream, because that was always my dream. It wasn't necessarily so much to compete professionally afterwards, because I didn't really know that you could even have a career professionally in the sport. It was very fulfilling. You know, it was very, very fulfilling considering the journey and all the adverse, especially that year going to the Olympics. I hurt myself in April. And it just, you know, it was just deja vu again and trying to keep it together for the games in August. And it was just a constant battle. And then I really strained my hamstring in Germany just 2 or 3 weeks prior to the Olympic Games. So I felt like, you know, here I am. I finally made my dream come through, and I may not be able to compete at the Olympics. So I just wanted to be able to compete. It wasn't even so much about results. And I felt like, you know, this is just my first Olympics, and, you know, the next one, that's when I was going to really make a real impact, you know. And but it was very, very fulfilling. You know, it was very, very rewarding. And the fact that I was able to run the times that I, you know, like when I first went to Northern Arizona, they interviewed me and they said, well, what times do you want to run? And I said, I want to run 45 seconds. And, you know, what time do you think you can run in 200 meters? And I said, 20 point. And I was able to achieve all those things, you know, within the second year of that interview. So I felt like I had fulfilled those, you know, those aspirations and those goals. And, It felt great.
Excellent. You ran during that era when basically that crop, you guys were absolute rock stars. And I remember, you know, when you, that basically, that platoon, I mean, you guys sold out stadiums all over the world. How did it feel? because I mean, you know, basically you guys were marquee, we call it athletes. You guys basically you were movie stars. How did it feel? I mean, you really were. You were. I mean, literally in the paper, there would literally be there were sightings like that. That's how special our Canadian sprinters are. That's how special that era was. How did it feel?
It was great. You know, it was surreal. I mean, honestly, you don't really know. You know, you really don't know how to act or how to. You know, you really don't know. You know, expect you really don't know what the you know what to do in terms of how to how to receive all that. You know, because but yeah, I remember when I was in Japan, Tokyo, and I decided to leave the interior of the track and go up in the stands just to look around, you know. And before I knew it, you know, I had like about 100 people surround me. And I was like, whoa, you know, and they're asking for autograph and so forth, you know. But that was kind of like the first, you know, real experience of that, because oftentimes you don't really interact with the crowd. But that was one of those moments where I got a chance to interact with the crowds. And obviously, you know, I was in Germany one time and I was with Ben Johnson, and we were just sitting down after warming up. We were on the same 4x1 relay, and he was just sitting down, and, you know, we just get all sorts of people just, you know, coming and asking for autograph. And some people had pictures of Ben that they wanted to have, you know, autograph. And, you know, that was a very unique experience, especially seeing how he handled, you know, that kind of attention.
Yeah, fabulous. Absolutely fantastic. You know, it's, I really do hope that people can absorb the gratitude, or sorry, the gravity of how special and rare it is to have that many sprinters of that quality, because that it's unprecedented and absolutely incredible. It's incredible and really should be heralded in Canadian history. It really should, because it is phenomenal, and probably will never happen again. My next question: do you feel that the Dubbin Inquiry may have impeded your career?
Yeah, I think definitely. I think, you know, and I think it still does impact the sport. I think, you know, the inquiry and the investigation and everything that was said there has really tarnished the sport, the image of the sport, and it has left a perception that, you know, everyone is dirty once they have, you know, perform at a high level. And I, you know, I can attest to that. I perform at a high level, and that's definitely not the case for me. So, you know, I feel that, you know, after the Dublin inquiry, all the sponsors left, a lot of coaches that, you know, left the sport or, you know, took a leave of absence, so to speak. And the potential courses, which are normally the athletes who, you know, competed or about to retire, would normally step into coaching positions, you know, left, disappeared. So, you know, and to compound matters, you know, we had one of the worst recessions, you know, after 88 going into the early 90s. So, yeah, absolutely. You know, it made everything a lot tougher, you know. And I remember even though as an employee as TD, I remember my manager, you know, try to solicit to get some sponsorship through TD. And they came back and said, well, we can only do teams. We don't do individuals. So, you know, I could even though I was an employee, I could even get sponsored by my employer, You know, and the problem is that when you sponsor an organization or a company, all that funding get tied up in administration. It doesn't get trickled down to the individual who needs that. It's just in all administrative costs mostly. So it was a very, very, very tough time for me, you know, especially, you know, seeing guys that, you know, I defeated in college and after college, going on to win medals. So yeah, it was very tough.
Yeah. Well, unjustifiably so. But anyways, those Canadian sprinters deserve all the accolades. That they worked hard for. Guys, they were all champions. And who I have before me was an incredible champion. And as a Canadian, I'm proud. I am very proud of this whole group and Anthony Wilson. Anthony, for the up-and-coming sprinters that are aspiring and love the sport just as much as you do and dream of maybe one day being on the world stage, what advice do you have for them?
Well, my advice would be to get the best coach that you can. Always go where, you know, the knowledge is. It's important for your development. Be in a warm weather situation. It's conducive to sprinting. Sprinting and warm weather go hand in hand. And, if you're staying in Canada, again, knowledge, the best coaching with experience is where you want to be. There's some challenges here, but, you know, things are much different today than it was during my time coming up. But ultimately, if you want to succeed, then you need to get in with one of the camps. You need to get into the NCAA system. It will prepare you for you're getting the best coaches in the system. You're getting the best competition in the system. And you're able to, you know, attain not only a degree, but you're able to you get the best of both worlds. So that would be my advice. Try and get a scholarship if you can, and then get developed that way. Go to a school with a track record. Maintain your body. Don't get hurt. You know, try and do everything to prevent injury. Don't take anything for granted and not cool down and warm up and those sort of things, because those are very important. And and I think you're on your journey. Once you're in Canada, if you can excel in Canada, then you're part of the conversation as far as being one of the greats. You know, if you can excel here, then you can win an Olympic medals. You know, if you look at the history of the sprints, Canada, you know, has always been in the mix, you know, whether it's the 100 meter or, you know, the 4x1 relay, we're always there. So we're part of there. See, so you know that you're on that trajectory, you know. So, you know, don't ever think that you don't have a chance. You do, you know. And sometimes when you're here and you're young, you probably think, you know, you might look up to, I mean, times are very different now, but back then it was like Carl Lewis. You know, you may look and see what they're doing. You may think, man, that journey seems so far away, you know, to get to that level, but you're at that level. you know, you're really at that level. And once you get into that environment, because environment is key to success in anything, whether it's education or success, you know, whether in business or in sport, the environment really mold you and you know, get you to the next level. So absolutely.
Okay. And there you have it with the champ, Anthony, the Jet Wilson. And this is J11 Retrospective, the Gil Answer. We are out.
Thank you, Gil.